coming broadcast so that it would seem as if it was a coincidence of the signals not being quite precise.
Yeah, it's a very interesting topic, and thanks for pointing this out, really. This was, I think this is also a very interesting aspect to it, and it can have interesting, you know, artistic aesthetic implications. From their perspective, of course, this had, you know, fairly practical reasons. What is the most effective way to interrupt foreign broadcasts? You know, what sounds can cover, make the incoming, you know, signal as unintelligible as possible. Again, how not to listen to this sound, right? That was the point. And so in the beginning, as you said, they use some kind of high-pitched, you know, sine wave-like sound, which, let's be honest, can be quite annoying after a certain amount of time. It's not too pleasant. It's very good for testing. It's very good for monitoring. It has very, very good features. But listening to it, so they were kind of right, but our ears are fascinating in the sense that you can still perfectly understand speech with a sine wave on top of it, or next to it, or under it. So, I mean, it is annoying, but you can hear everything. So what's the point, right? Well, people were desperate, in dire need of information. What the hell is going on in their country? Whether there will be a third world war? What's happening with the nuclear warfare? You know, of course, people needed that information and they were annoyed by this sine wave. So what, you know? So they still listened to it. It was totally worth it. So they decided, okay, then, you know, we'll use some broadband noise type of sound, you know? Sometimes just, you know, a recording of the transmitter engine, really, you know, which is just this very noisy thing. Once I went in Lithuania to radio transmitting site, which probably was used for jamming as well before the Iron Curtain fell, and the transmitters were extremely loud. I mean, we are talking about analog equipment, and they were really loud. So sometimes they would basically stream, you know, the sound of the transmitters to the air, which was way more effective. It was way more tiring for the ear, but still you could hear it, because again, our ears are amazing and we can still filter out speech from a static noise background. So it was still not effective, although way better than, you know, sine waves. The next thing was fluctuating noise. So instead of a static noise, they would change kind of, they would do some filtering on it, and then they would change the filter frequency, the cutoff frequency, in a way that it would fluctuate up and down, you can try to look up, you know, what this might mean. which was more effective because, okay, it was a dynamic sound compared to static sound, because with a static soundscape, you can still decipher the speech. With a dynamic sound or a moving sound, let's say, with moving characteristics, it becomes a bit more difficult. And then, as you said, they went to use human speech. And then they would use this interesting device. I read about it. So they where the, how they produced this multi-layer of speeches. It was basically like three, four layers of, you know, official radio shows, you know. Sometimes they would use this record player where the needle would be placed on two points on top of the vinyl. So it would pick up one part of the vinyl and another part of the vinyl in the same time. So the two needles would be transmitted, you know, to the ether and to, you know, used to jam. So that's the way they could create like two channels of different spoken word. Now this was very effective, especially if it was in the same language as, you know, your own. So for example, if let's say a Hungarian broadcast was jammed by a Russian, you know, show, it wasn't as effective because you don't understand Russian. If it was jammed by Hungarian, there was no way you can listen to, you can hear, or sorry, to understand.
And then I think a later technique was also pop music.
Yeah, I mean, that was a special case, exactly. But yeah, probably that was very difficult to decipher as well. But I think it wasn't for so long, because I think from what I remember, this happened in like early 80s. And my 88 radio jamming kind of ceased to exist. Not cease to exist. I mean, the infrastructure was there in that sense, yes. But jamming activities decreased exponentially in 88. So we can say that, you know, Cold War radio jamming kind of finished around that time. So I think in the 80s, yeah, again, depends on which country, but, you know, in this era of glasnost, you know, this era of opening up, you know, jamming became less, you know, important. So I think that was for a short amount of time, and I would put it in the category of like spoken word, because it's also very much changing. It's not a static sound. Some of them might have, you know, some speech in it, or, you know, like someone singing, and then you kind of pay attention to the music, and it's hard to, you know, filter out the speech, spoken word behind it. But yeah, it was a practice for a little while.
You shared a recording of from 1983. Can you tell us a little bit about that? We're going to play it. And if you can tell us what some of the jamming practices are that are being played out in this recording from 1983.
Yeah, I got it from an acquaintance whose parents or grandparents recorded it for some reason. Not sure what was the reason for it, but it was really, really inspiring to listen to it. And I was very happy that she gave it to me. And so what happens, what we didn't discuss yet, was call signs. Call signs are Morse codes, like repeating Morse codes of like couple of letters, or, you know, two letters and a number. And call signs are, call signs are kind of like, you, how can I put it? So these are like signals, like codes, which communicate a certain thing. In radio jamming practices, it had different functions. For example, let's say a certain Secret Service agent had a particular code, right? Like CW5. And they had sometimes Secret Service agents would have a little book that showed, that told them when to listen to a certain frequency. Let's say they said, next week on Wednesday, tune in to 93.8 megahertz because you will get a message, right? Or we will broadcast encrypted messages for Secret Service agents, let's say, right? And then you tuned in as three, and then the first one, okay, you listen to the call sign, which was NK4. Okay, this a message is not for you. Then you wait until your message comes, and that's how they communicated sometimes. So this was one way to use call signs, for example. On radio jamming, it was, from what I know, was sometimes used. Look, here I have to say that, you know, the available of documents and texts and literature was very limited. So I'm saying that what I know is from what limited, you know, data I could gather through my research. So the call signs might have used also for different purposes. I can only say what, you know, I know at the moment, you know, about what call signs were might have been used for jamming purposes. So as we discussed before, there were monitoring sites in the socialist bloc who were listening in to their own jamming signal and also the foreign broadcasts in order to adjust the jamming so that it covers the foreign signal. And call signs were first kind of used as a way to check how strong their own jamming signal was, because with a sine wave you can check that quite nicely. Your ears can adjust to it. The other thing was to transmit communication very fast, saying like, so showing the scope, like let's say a jamming site had a call sign of, again, DW6, and you know, if you transmitted this call sign as well, you could monitor whether you could listen to this call sign in a far remote area or not, or how well you could do, how well you could listen to it, you know? So this way you could, yeah, pretty much check the quality of the jamming and check the quality, which jamming sites are present in that area. Oh yeah, and then sorry. So this starts, okay, in the recording, this starts, you can hear a Morse code repeating. And it also, you know, is probably a way to show that start jamming now, because depending on what was covered in the news, you know, if there was something extremely sensitive politically and diplomatically, you had to jam like crazy. You know, if it was about flowers and trees, you didn't need to, you know, or fishes in the sea, you didn't have to really, because it was not. But if it was like shipping rights, who has shipping rights in north of, you know, on the border of Norway and Soviet Union, then you have to jam as crazy as possible, because that's about borders and politics and, you know, or oil fields between Soviet Union and Russia. Whoa, okay. But if it's about the iceberg close to Svalbard, you know, it's pretty much neutral from a political perspective. But when it becomes, you know, this iceberg melting and, you know, floating towards, you know, the south, because I don't know, China is polluting or the Netherlands is polluting the world, then you know, then it becomes you see what I mean? And then you have to. But that was also, you know, kind of the responsibility of the monitoring site, who said that you have to, you know, start jamming now because it's a very sensitive subject politically. And this is what happens in the recording. that you hear the voice, and you know it's noisy, but you can kind of recognize, you know, you can follow what the person is saying, and then suddenly it's becoming this huge, you know, like invasion of crazy sounds, you know, at some point. You listen to it, I remember yesterday, and that was it, like suddenly this wall of sound, really, like wall of noise enters, and they do all their best to make it unintelligible, which they do for a bit.
És elvezették volna a legközelebbi repülőtérre, ha nem távozik a japán felsővizet irányába. Annak beismerése vált a dél-koreai repülőgép lelövésére, közvetlenül a szovjet légitér elhagyása előtt került sor. Hurkoltan ez jelenti, a szovjet légelhárítóknak nem volt szabad a lehetnek az öltözött repülőgépben. Kétségtelenül azt az utasítást kaptam feletteseiktől, hogy vagy kerítsék kézre a repülőgépet, vagy semmisítsék meg. A fedélzeten tartózkodó 260 személy a Szovjetunió üldözési mániájának eset áldozatul. Ezáltal megnövekedett a kétek, hogy elegendők-e a jelenlegi biztonsági intézkedések az atomkatasztrófa emberi őrültség által történő kirobbantásának megakadályozására. Feltéti befejezésül a Divelt munkatársa.
So we're hearing a Morse code on top of the broadcast, so that's part of the jamming, correct?
Exactly. It's it might be, you know, an indicator or warning for monitoring operators that the unwanted broadcast is devoid of sufficient jamming. And jamming transmitter need to be readjusted, for example. Because radio, like the fastest way to communicate to transmitters were through radio.
And just to give a scene, the people who were actually listening, you talk about the gender differences in the roles and the jamming industry. And I think women were the ones listening. Would that be possibly a woman who was sending the Morse code to the person who was maybe a man at the actual transmission jamming site?
Yeah, I really wanted to find more information about it. But yeah, as you say, it was mostly women who worked at monitoring sites. I think they were listening in and giving, yeah, probably back information. Might be through Morse code. I wouldn't be 100% sure, as I don't, unfortunately, I don't really know at the moment, but it makes sense. So this is a very interesting issue again, the gender divide and in terms of division of labor. It's, for me, it's kind of the classic thing, you know, we you know, in the jamming infrastructure, and, you know, those positions that were more respected, let's say, because of it needed engineering background, it needed technical skills. You know, you work with massive machines, turning knobs, pushing buttons, adjusting the meters, whatnot, calibrating the machines. You know, you were also kind of in a power position, meaning, you know, you were operating on an extreme, sometimes very powerful radio station. That was a man's job, right? The monitoring was extremely tedious job. Listening to noisy sounds for a long time per day was very, very tiring, and it didn't need necessarily, you know, like formal educational background. You know, you were saying like, if you hear this, say this. You know, it was very kind of lower skilled labor, which is weird to say because you have to be on top of your thing nonstop. You had to have good ears. You had to pay attention. You had to react fast, you know, I mean, but I know, I hope you know what I mean, you know, that in like a formal context, this needed less, you know, skills and previous formal education, especially in engineering. So I think it's like this typical thing that ended up being, you know, the phenomenon of it was mostly women who did this job. I mean, monitoring. And of course, as you know, like the turnover was very, very high because it was very, very difficult to listen to and react and do the right thing in these monitoring sites.
Do you know any non-English words for the word jamming?
Yes, I know the Hungarian word for it, Radio Zavaras, which means radio Zavaras. Yeah, it's interference, but also disorder, can mean disorder, can mean entropy, you know, so it's kind of this word that means a lot of things, but, you know, in this context, it means radio interference and radio jamming. In Romanian, it's called bruiaj, for example, which comes from, you know, can be related to the French bruit, like noise. So Romanians would call it bruiaj. I think the Dutch call it storting, but I wouldn't be completely sure about this, which also is in the realm of, you know, I think radio interference, jamming, but also kind of disorder and, you know, entropy. But I wouldn't be 100% about it, about the Dutch way to say it. I wonder how it's said in Norwegian, though.
Good question.
Yeah, please, listeners, please let Karen know how you in Norway, in Norwegian. Also, regionalisms are very welcome, and I would be very curious as well how it is said.
So if I recall from your writing, the recording that we are still hearing was followed a week later by a bombing of or some kind of a downing of a flight, I think from Korea. Can you talk about what connection might be theorized or speculated about this broadcast and that flight where I think over 200 people were killed?
Yeah, exactly. So it was the kind of so this Korean airline flight 007 was flying from New York City to Seoul via Alaska, and Soviet Air Force aircraft. I think from what I know, they had a miscommunication from the Soviet side, and this aircraft, Soviet military aircraft, downed, shot this Boeing 747 aircraft and everyone died. This was in 83 when, you know, from what I know, diplomatic negotiations started between the West, like US and the USSR, about some, you know, again, warming up of diplomatic relations, you know. This again is like early 80s, so 80s was really about, you know, this close kind of approaching of the two worlds, you know, the United States and the Soviet Union towards each other. And this kind of mistake, again, probably most documents and data about this situation, this aircraft disaster, is probably confidential to this day. So you can't be sure precisely what actually happened. Probably, from what I know, there was some miscommunication, so it wasn't meant to be, an attack by the Soviet Union towards South Korea. It was probably a mistake, you know? Maybe the Korean aircraft, Boeing 747, civilian aircraft, entered Soviet, airspace, and the Soviet Union misunderstood this somehow, you know, like a horrible mistake. And I think this really had strong diplomatic consequences, you know, and it kind of hampered this process of approaching or getting close to each other. And I think this radio show, from what I remember, it was, yeah, they were discussing this event at length. Because, you know, during the Cold War, any small, this is horrible, 200 people died, of course. But in terms of, you know, it wasn't like a war between two sovereign countries, you know, it was a stupid mistake, you know, and it's horrible, but it was blown up because no one knew anything at all. And, you know, any small spike could, you know, it could burst out into this massive forest burning because someone dropped a cigarette end, you know, and then it was dry. Well, you know what I mean? Like, it could easily explode. And so you had to be really aware what was happening. I think they're discussing that probably some, there were some diplomatic negotiations and there were some, some kind of mild threats to each other about this happening.
Keresztények és a mohamedánok ellenségeskedésre egyre nagyobb méreteket ölt azóta, hogy az iráni csapatok vasárnap kivonultak a Súf-hegységben lévő állásaikból. A szemben álló felek kísérletet tesznek arra, hogy megszerezzék a hangoldést a hegyvidék felett. Jeruzsálemben tegnap közölték, hogy az izraeliek a Súf-hegységből való kivonulás előtt...
When you think about radio jamming... It has a literal meaning, as we're hearing, but then metaphorically, what does it raise for you?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it's difficult to say, you know, because if I'm looking to it from a political, ethical, and moral perspective, you know, I would come to a very different conclusion if I would look at it from the aspect we were discussing so far, you know, the artistic, aesthetic potential in it, the physical aspect to it, the interconnectedness of this huge infrastructure, peoples, you know, the environment, solar activity, the atmosphere, the surface of the earth, different jamming techniques. then it's, yeah, so it's a bit, it's a good question, but it's a kind of a difficult one, because it's, yeah, hard to get a conclusion, because it's conceptually, I think what's interesting is this, for me, conceptually, is this idea of flipping, you know, previously taken for granted notions on their heads, you know, flipping them around. What silence is, what silencing is, what, you know, making sound is about, you know, what, I don't know, how sound, politics, society, and ecology can interconnect in this extremely interesting system. Yeah, probably this would be my answer to your question.
I'm intrigued by the secret and the hiding of communication and what that does to a listener, and this going back to the secret speech that did so much to respond to Stalin, and the power of a speech that is secret, and the power perhaps of a transmission that is fragmented. I'm curious what that brings up for you.
Yeah, I think this brings up an aspect of this phenomenon of radio, Cold War radio jamming, which I find was very inspirational, that you had to make an effort all the time to gain information. Some of the listeners might know about this thing called Samizdat, which were illegal journals in socialist blocs, which were distributed basically manually. They were printed illegally and distributed manually. So there was this huge effort to get information, to get to certain sounds, to listen to certain musics, you know, not only, you know, trying to hear what these foreign broadcasts were transmitting, but also get wrapping your head around, you know, how you can listen to it, you know, the technical aspect to it, what you have to do, when you have to wake up, because there is this 20-minute window when there's no way the jamming can interrupt the incoming signal. So you wake up at 6 o'clock before work, and for 20 minutes you listen to the news, you know. You had to be, yeah, this active element in order to bypass as much as possible the secretive element to it. You know, it's not this passive audience, it's a very active audience, to the extent that, you know, people from the West were sending kind of encrypted messages via Radio Free Europe saying like, hey, we are White Rabbit and we are safely arrived to Paris and the kids are well, love you, whatever, you know, Kate and the children, because you couldn't, you know, if you say Kate Woodington or whatever, you know, then they check you and they might incarcerate you and your whole family back in the socialist bloc. So you had to decipher it somehow. So, you know, like even in this sense, there was this active listening and active participation as an audience or a consumer of media. There was no way you could just lay back, you know, and receive.
Next week, we're going to be interviewing in the station at Radio Multe someone who was very involved in a protest against a company called Clear Channel, which is a multinational advertising and media company. And the protests in Bergen that this person was involved with stopped Clear Channel from advertising in all the bus stops all over the city. And I'm intrigued by this name of this company, which has a huge impact on the radio and advertising world in the US, where I come from. They now own something. They've changed their name to iHeartMedia, and they own so many commercial radio stations. And in a way, kind of, you could say they jam the diversity of radio stations. They kind of make this homogeneous broadcast across the US. And again, invest so much in advertising in different parts of Europe. So I'm intrigued by what we've been talking about and even the name of this company, Clear Channel. And maybe this gets at also something in your thesis. You refer to Jacques Attali's idea of noise and ideology. So I guess I just wanted to see what kind of thoughts you have when you hear something about this company, Clear Channel, in the context of our conversation about radio jamming.
Yeah, thanks for asking, and kudos for this person for doing this in Bergen. I highly support these causes. So Clear Channel sounds very cynical for me, you know, because you can also silence something and things with saying that you're transparent, for example, you know, while you're not, you know, and you say, you know, so you can call a company or a sovereign state a certain name, like democratic, people's democratic, whatever, when there's no democracy in it at all, you know? And so you can, you know, choose a name that is kind of opposite to what you stand for, although I don't know details about this company, and unfortunately not too much about this protest, but at first glance it sounds very cynical to me, and it's called a Clear Channel, you know, like Clear Channel would be something like, okay, you know, I don't know if there's something available like this, like, you know, grassroots projects or small projects would be provided advertisement space for free, for example, in bus stations, like Radio Multe could be, you know, and then have like two posters, you know, provided for free, you know, on the main square of Bergen, you know, on two bus stations for like 2 weeks. That's great, you know, or in other civil organizations like, you know, Association of Young Muslims in Bergen, you know, who do, you know, community work in Bergen. Awesome. Give them, you know, 3 weeks of free advertisements all around Bergen, you know, to spread the word, you know, that join us, it's a nice youth organization, blah, blah, blah. If that exists in Bergen, I don't know. But, you know, that's a Clear Channel, you know, when you provide free advertisement platforms that are very visible for the population and the community of Bergen, you know. But yeah, commercialization of advertisement spaces, that doesn't sound the most Clear Channel to me, you know. So yeah. So secret and the silence has very different, it's not as obvious as you might think, right? At first glance, it's like, oh yeah, silence. But then when you think about it, when you are faced with these phenomena, then you're like, oh, okay, it means something completely the opposite even. when in the same times it's pretty much the same, but how it manifests the complete opposite, as you might have thought in your wildest dreams. Yeah.
I wonder if the clear channel makes us passive as listeners. When is a clear channel valuable, and when is a clear channel make us lazy?
Yeah, that's a good question. It does kind of make us lazy, but in terms of, you know, passive maybe, but you know, there are people who commute on a daily basis, especially in massive, you know, like New York, Paris, London, you know, for hours on end, like sometimes 3 or 4 hours, especially during the pandemic. And you don't really wanna, you know, after a shift of work, despite, you know, there is COVID-19, you know, stupid boss doesn't let you work from home because whatever reason, they're idiots, you know, and your boss is an idiot. And then you have to, you know, still commute for hours in a congested, you know, bus or train or tram, you know, still on a daily basis. And then you just want to put in your headphones, listen to podcast, and just like look out of your head and hoping, you know, you will get home in time to your children. You know what I'm saying? So I don't mind that people have the opportunity for a clear signal. And I think it's a kind of a human right, really, to have clear signals. But also, I do think that, you know, so being an active listener is nice, but too bad, you know, that it was the premise of this was an oppressive political context, you know. Otherwise, it's a really nice idea that, you know, you can, you should make. And I think there are efforts to this, you know, like actively participate in different things. I mean, in the US, you know, in general, this was the case in the last period of time, you know, like with the BLM movement, like a lot of people got involved and active, you know, in general. Sorry, I'm extending this notion a bit, but you see what I mean. You know, not passive acceptors, but yeah, active listeners and active participators.
We've been listening to Signals and Connections on Radio Multe, transmitting live in Bergen, Norway at 93.8 FM and at Wave Farm. Thank you so much, Andres, for your generous sharing about radio jamming and Cold War era. And thank you, Fabian Landsmeyer, for wonderful scoring of this transmission. Thank you, Su Lau, for presence here documenting this.
Thanks for the invitation. It was wonderful to talk to you, Karen.
Thanks again. Thank you for listening to Radio Multe, 93.8 FM in Bergen, Norway. This is Karen Werner, redactor of Radio Multe. I hope you've been enjoying this romp through the Radio Multe archive this week. It's been really a treat to listen back with some of you to some of the amazing things that have emerged from the show, from the station last year. And looking forward to a lot of new programmers joining the Radio Multe family. Have a really good rest of your evening and your week. And from Radio Multe, good night.